So you think you know about Chicago politics. Well, on this edition of the Extension 720 podcast exclusive, you're going to learn a lot more. And you're going to learn it from a man who's done what the French call a roman à clé, that is, a novel with a key. And if you know how to decipher it, it's based upon real people and real events. Except it's rather confounding because things take an odd turn which don't quite parallel the recent history of Chicago politics. Yes, the novel is about Chicago politics. It is titled The Chairman, and the author is Mark M. Quinn. And I've had great fun reading this novel and trying to decode it.
Well, thank you, Milt. Most people have, and I'm not even sure I've decoded it, but it's a novel that moves nicely. It gives people an opportunity to really learn about the politics of our city without being dragged down by what some people might consider a boring nonfiction track. This is a compelling story, which not only entertains the reader but informs the reader a great deal about.
There's
our
nothing
city.
Boring in here. The Chairman, that being the title of the novel, is in fact, and I love the way you named him, Eamon de Valera Collins, a member of the Chicago City Council, and the chairman of the Zoning Committee, who insists upon being addressed as the chairman.
The chairman, right. He is called the chairman by all but his closest friends. If you get to the point where you can call him by his first name, Eamon, you've really made it in politics. But there's very few of those people.
And he's a man of considerable power, but he doesn't certainly want to be mayor, though things take an interesting turn later in the novel. Because the real power and the real money is made elsewhere in Chicago politics, not on the fifth floor of City Hall.
At least at that time it was. Now
he
became chairman, he became committeeman and alderman of the fictional 15th Ward in 1963. And at that time, and the book moves forward from 63, obviously by the time of the major story of the book in 1989, he's been around many, many years. But back in those days, the real money was made being committeeman and possibly alderman. Because
let's get right down to it.
Sure.
Politics is a very profitable business in Chicago if you play it right. How do you make the money?
You make money in Chicago politics, and even to this day you make money in Chicago politics, by getting a license to do something, be it a lawyer, be it an insurance agent. Back in the old days, back in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, a bartender, it didn't really matter. But a way for people to channel money to you legitimately for your influence.
For your influence, not as a bartender.
Or as a lawyer or as an insurance agent.
But your influence in the city council?
In the city council.
Or in city government more
broadly.
Right.
So you might select a prominent city council member to be your attorney for zoning appeals or tax appeals. You might buy your insurance through a politically connected insurance person who may or may not be a committeeman, but may be attached to a committeeman one way or the other. But that is the way money gets funneled into these people. And they've always written the ethics legislation loosely, so that things like this can take place. You can't take a bribe. You can't go to the alderman and say, here, alderman, here's $50,000. Change my zoning.
But recent research has revealed that something like one-third of all serving Chicago aldermen since 1960 or thereabouts have gone to prison.
Yes, they have.
They don't go to prison just for taking large fees as lawyers or as insurance people, do they?
Because greed is a big thing, and enough is never enough.
So they take bribes.
And they take bribes. And they take bribes usually in the form of a piece of a property, a commercial or a residential property, or something like that. And even the people, for instance, Tom Keene being the perfect example of that, who was the first Mayor Daley's mm-hmm. floor leader and chairman of the Finance Committee, was a lawyer, was in a position to take what George Washington Plunkett called honest graft, but was not satisfied with that and made some zoning changes and managed to buy, either with his own money or with grateful people's money, property that he later changed the zoning on and therefore made the value of skyrocket.
Even so-called honest reform aldermen have been capable of taking bribes. There was one from the Hyde Park area.
Right.
Larry.
And I knew you were going to ask me his last name. It'll come to me, but it's just
he
not
was
coming
my alderman at
he
the time.
He was your alderman. He succeeded.
He was a frequent guest on this program.
Right.
As a commentator on Chicago politics.
Right.
Ultimately, he was caught by the feds, taking $10,000 or $20,000 for some sort of fix, and I think served a little bit of time.
And what surprised me about that.
Larry Bloom.
That's right. He succeeded Leon Dupre.
Yeah.
in 1975. And he was alderman for quite some time. He didn't get nailed until the early 90s, I mm-hmm. believe. What surprised me about that, Milton, call me cynical, was that he did it for so little money.
Exactly.
You could understand it in some of the other wards. At the same time, some other aldermen went down, the same investigation. But they were in poor wards. And, you know, $10,000, $20,000, it was a lot of money to them. But in a ward like the 5th Ward, Hyde Park, there's a lot of opportunities there for an enterprising young corrupt politician. So I was surprised he went down for so little money. I guess that's the cynicism of someone who observes Chicago politics.
He was.
Well, go ahead. I'm sorry.
He was potentially an amateur, I suppose.
Well, he was an amateur.
An amateur at the game of corruption.
Oh, yes, he was. He was. And it showed he was an amateur. The big guys, the important people, would have never got caught at that. And you mentioned independents who got into trouble. Now, he's never been convicted. He's never been indicted. But remember, when Edward Oleak last got into trouble, one of his partners was Bill Singer. Remember, the 75 mm-hmm. independent candidate for mayor. He had quite a reputation as a reformer. So, you know, people hang around power long enough, and they get close to it, and they see other people taking. And again, Singer's never been convicted of anything. He's maybe not necessarily did anything wrong. But he was in these deals with Edward Oleak. This happens after a while. You see other people taking theirs. Why not take yours?
We plunged right into real Chicago politics and the history thereof, mm-hmm. rather than this fine novel of yours, which is inspired by Chicago politics, mm-hmm. but takes a very interesting turn. In the chairman, the mayor, and he rather reminds you of the First Daily, is mm-hmm. Mayor O'Malley.
Right, Bill O'Malley.
Who is in trouble with the feds. They're going to pounce on him and maybe put him on charges. And it would, but he confesses. He pleads guilty and accepts a slap on the wrist sort of punishment, but he goes on to run for mayor again. Now, that doesn't parallel the actual history of Mayor Daley. However, something else that surely does not parallel the history of Mayor Daley is just about a week before his election, and the only other candidate in the field is somebody running as a reform candidate, some kind of trivial guy from the East Coast named Dempsey, who wants to be a reform politician in Chicago, and he manages to get the certification or the endorsement of a reform organization, which sounds a good deal like Independent Voters of Illinois, IVI.
Mm-hmm.
But a week before the election, O'Malley is shot down, is assassinated, as he's going to meet an alderman who reminds me very much of Vito Marzullo.
Right, Alderman Vito Brancato.
Yeah.
The legendary Alderman Vito Brancato, as he's referred to in the book. Now, again, no one in the book is anybody, right? These are all fictional characters, but certainly that's...
Oh, as you read this, you can't help
it. You can't help it. That's
after
very
all, Leon
close to
Bernstein,
Vito Marzullo.
The purest no alderman from the ward around the University of Chicago, though this is never defined as the city of Chicago. You never mentioned
right.
Chicago in the book. Leon Bernstein is obviously Leon Dupre.
Clearly, he's Leon Dupre, and he is the independent. He's the independent conscience of the city council. All the independents tend to gravitate toward him because he's the man. He's the man who's
yeah.
fought the wars alone many times, just like Leon Dupre.
He was all of that.
He was all of that. Leon Dupre was, in many ways, a very great man. Now, he and I certainly would have had disagreements on politics.
But what most Chicagoans did not know about Leon Dupre, and what I only learned towards the end of his life, I knew him, had him on the program a few times, is that in his youth, he was a follower of Leon Trotsky, even went down to Mexico City to consort with Trotsky in exile from Soviet Russia. In fact, on his honeymoon, Leon and his wife went down to visit with Trotsky, and Leon was probably a member of some communist party.
And admits it. In fact, I just finished his book not long ago.
Yeah.
And he said that. It was something I did in my youth. It was one of the foibles of my youth.
And a good friend of Saul Alinsky, you know, people of that sort.
Certainly. There's no doubt about it. Leon Dupre was an independent. Leon Dupre was clearly a liberal. Some would call him a radical when he was young. But that doesn't sell too poorly in the Fifth Ward.
No.
He did very well in the Fifth Ward. And he was alderman there for 20 years, paralleling almost exactly the first Mayor Daley's reign.
Now, back to where your novel, The Chairman, diverges from history. Mayor O'Malley is shot down.
Right.
And his reform opponent gets elected.
Right. Tom Dempsey gets elected because he's the only guy on the ballot. Who are you going to vote for? I mean, O'Malley remained on the ballot, but he's a dead man. And that's come up before in the Missouri senatorial election, for instance, who you vote for when the man is dead. And that was relatively recent. But
Dempsey discovers that He's got a city council who will not cooperate with him on anything.
Who is very hostile. Not only that, but there is another character, a political operative in the book named Mike Padden, who is secretly manipulating Mr. Dempsey. And Mr. Dempsey is not, he's a young man. He's not seasoned in the mores of politics. He doesn't know he's being manipulated. Mike Padden has planted his cousin in this organization called ICON, and he's been manipulating things behind the scenes. So whether he knows it or not, Tom Dempsey is acting as an agent of one wing of the former machine.
And what is Mike Padden after?
Mike Padden's after several people, many, many people throughout Chicago politics. I don't want to name any names, but there's several political operatives in Chicago, most of whom have held office at one time or another, who could easily match the description of Mike Padden.
But what is he after for himself?
Mike Padden, he sets up Dempsey. Dempsey wants to be a reformer. He wants to take control of the machine himself. He just has just decided he is the best candidate for it. He's been friends with Collins, allies with Collins for many, many years. He uses that when it suits him. But Padden simply wants to run the machine. He doesn't want an office. He doesn't want to be mayor. He doesn't even necessarily want to be committeeman, although he mentioned it before and he knew he wasn't going to get that. He wanted to be the big money guy behind the scenes. And in that sense, he's kind of prototypical of the political operatives who are lurking behind the scenes now. Maybe everybody doesn't know their names. Not everybody reads the Tribune or the Sun-Times knows their names, but everybody in politics know who these people are. They're what John Cass calls the guys behind the guys. Mm-hmm. Padden is the ultimate guy behind the guy and is manipulating this young mayor against his former allies, by the way. He's so bold he goes against his former allies.
Time to bring in another character, and he shows up very early, and he keeps showing up in the book. He's a councilman, Pete Arvey. Interestingly, you choose the name Arvey.
Arvey.
Jake Arvey was a very important figure in Chicago Democratic Organization a long time ago. But Pete Arvey is, in fact, the man on the council who represents nothing less than the criminal syndicate, the outfit, as we call it here, or the mafia.
Right. He is the mafia's mouthpiece. He's an attorney who speaks for the mob. So when Chairman Collins or Mike Padden or Bill O'Malley wants to talk to the mobsters, they talk to Pete Arvey. Pete Arvey is another guy behind the guys. But when you want to communicate with the mob, with the outfit, we don't even refer to the outfit in the book because we don't necessarily say it's Chicago, although everyone knows it is. Pete Arvey is the man.
Well, how much does that correspond to, or what does that draw from reality? That is, to what degree is the outfit, was the outfit then, and is the outfit even now, a significant sector of power in Chicago life and Chicago politics, maybe the ultimate arbiter of political decisions?
I think that to call them the ultimate arbiter would be going too far, but they are a major player and always have been a major player in Chicago
politics. How do they exert their power?
Well, they controlled for years several wards, the first ward being the most prominent, which contained
which was the loop at
the time. They've since moved it. And controlled several wards. Some said they controlled the 25th, which was Marzullo's ward. There's a lot of argument about that. And several West Side wards. They call them the river wards. And, you know, the Jewish and the Italian wards roughly along the river were controlled by the outfit. They've always been very strong. In fact, when the first Mayor Daley was mayor, naive people would ask the question, is Mayor Daley politically powerful enough to disable the mob in Chicago? People would say, why would he want to do that? They're on his side. There's considerable speculation that they carried the 1960 election for John F. Kennedy, which actually they didn't carry the election for John F. Kennedy. They carried it for Dan Ward. Dan Ward was running for state's attorney against Ben Adamowski. Ben Adamowski was a rival of Richard J. Daley. He ran against him for mayor in the primary in 1955. Daley beat him in a four-way election or three-way election. He was elected state's attorney, Adamowski, in 56 and was going after the machine. Had he been able to remain in power, he could have caused real problems for Daley. Well, Daley wanted very much to get him out of there and enlisted the help of his mob pals in the River Ward, so to speak, to carry heavily, ostensibly for Kennedy because the Irish Catholic, we love this Irish Catholic boy. I don't think Daley cared if Kennedy was mayor. He may have said he did, but he was much more concerned to get Adamowski out of office. And he carried heavily in the wards where you think he'd carry, the mob-dominated West Side wards.
The mob is in the business of making a lot of money.
Yes, they are.
For themselves. If they're in partnership relationship with Chicago politicians, are they also helping to enrich those politicians.
Absolutely. One hand scratches, one hand washes the other, right?
How does the mob pay politicians?
The mob pays politicians by, A, supporting their campaigns, B, helping them out in wards where they can have influence, for instance, through directing business their way, through getting them involved in the various businesses that the mob is involved in, the club business, pavement business, the businesses that the mob has traditionally run, the legitimate businesses and the illegitimate businesses.
They give them a cut of the take.
They give them a cut of the take. And they always, and they're always there at election time. And we all know in Chicago that campaign contributions are not necessarily campaign contributions. A politician can garner all sorts of campaign contributions and maybe even legitimately use them for his campaign, but everybody on the campaign payroll is a brother or brother-in-law or a nephew.
So that's what the mob does for the politicians. What then do the politicians do for the mob?
Contracts, big contracts. In the paving business, in legalized gambling in Chicago. I mean, the mayor's been pressing for that for a long time, right?
But he assures us it will be clean.
He assures us it will be clean, but everyone knows it won't. Those are ways that they help the mob. The mob also wants people to look the other way when certain things take place, and I'm sure some of that goes on too. I mean, this is crime that doesn't really bother anybody. You know, it's a little gambling, it's a little loan sharking, so what? There were always rumors that when Jane Byrne was mayor, she went easy on the mob. That, in fact, the people she put in the police department, if you read Romer's books, Bill Romer's books, he goes ahead and makes that implication. He says that Byrne put mob-friendly people in charge of the police department to look the other way. Again, that was a long time ago. Now it's primarily money. They want money. They might need licensing for their clubs. They might need, of course, contracts with the city. Licensing for clubs is a big deal. When you have a friendly administration in town and you're engaged in the sorts of crime that the mob is engaged in, not hitting people over the head or shooting people in the street, it's immensely beneficial to your net worth.
When I came to Chicago a long time ago, 1965, the first Mayor Daley was there. He remained mayor for a long time until his death. We remember what then followed. And we have and have had for many years. He's served just about as long as his father, has he not?
I think he just passed him. I think
he
just
passed that point.
I think he has.
And he'll probably run yet once again if they let him.
Sure.
Or if he decides that it's not too dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
We were told it was a very corrupt machine, a lot of involvement of the mob, much corruption of many different varieties of the kind we've been talking about during the administration of the first Daley.
Mm-hmm.
But we are told as well that the machine sort of dissolved. The old political machine disappeared, and now we've got a new kind of politics under Daley number two, which does not involve the same kinds of payoff, the same kinds of under-the-table dealing, the same kinds of close relationship with the mob, and the same ways of making either honest graft or dishonest graft and dishonest profit for those who are involved in the political game. Is that or is that not true? Are we in an age in which the political machine at last has been ended? And even in Chicago, the city of great corruption in urban political life, even in Chicago, things have now been improved so much so that we can say that we're not too much different from cleaner cities like, say, Minneapolis. That's the question I pose for you, and I look forward to your answer right after we pause briefly for these words. I'm talking on this edition of the Special Extension 720 podcast program with Mark M. Quinn, who is the author of a fine new novel directly based upon and reflective of the realities of Chicago politics. The title of that novel, The Chairman. And the question I posed a moment ago is one I'm eager to get your response on. Are we politically as corrupt as we used to be, or indeed with the various people who served as mayor in transition between the two Daleys, have we arrived now at a point of comparative political purity?
No way. The machine has changed. and it's not gone away.
But it's still there?
It's still there. In fact, in many ways, some people say this book is an allegory for the way the politics of the city has changed. The power is no longer in the ward organizations and in the committeemen. To a certain extent, I'm sure it is. Some of these, the more powerful committeemen hold sway. But the power is now on the fifth floor of City Council. It's changed.
Of City Hall.
Fifth floor of City Hall in the mayor's office.
So this mayor is more powerful than his father was.
In some ways, yeah, and there's more money at stake.
Mm-hmm.
This isn't a case of the old days where you got a guy, you know, a job in streets and sand, and he'd go knock doors in your ward organization, and that was corruption. I'd put my brother-in-law on the payroll, and that would be a big deal. That was the politics of the old days, and occasionally we'll work a real estate deal here and there. Now it's huge city contracts. Things have been privatized. Well, why do you think things have been privatized? Someone like me, who is very favorably disposed toward the free market, should be very favorably disposed toward privatization. But privatization, really, it's awarding a monopoly to somebody. When you award a monopoly to someone, that's extremely lucrative for them, obviously.
What do you mean by privatization in the context of Chicago?
You know, whatever it might be, whether it's cleaning up after Taste of Chicago, whether they talk about privatizing the water system, they talk about privatizing the garbage trucks, but obviously the privatization of the parking meters, of the parking garages, of the Skyway. These sorts of contracts are multi-billion dollar contracts. They're much more lucrative. This is
with a lot of padding built in for the politicians.
A lot of padding built in for the appreciative politicians. And when you go to get these contracts, you hire as your lawyers and your representatives and your consultants, aldermen and committeemen and committeemen's son and politicians' nephews
and pay them exorbitant fees
for doing very little to grease your way into these situations. It's supposedly competitive bidding, but they've managed to rig things like that. The amount of money involved now, Milt, is astonishing.
But who are they dealing with? Who's at the other end of those corporate undertakings? It's not the mob, is it?
No. It's big corporations.
It's serious corporations.
So in that sense, yeah, the mob is probably less influential. But the mob controls a lot of clubs and things of that nature downtown. Mm-hmm. The mob controls, at least some people say it controls, I don't have proof of this, but people say it controls the paving business in this city. That, you know, paving contracts are done. One of the guys who's supposedly head of the mob is called the builder, you know, Andriaki.
And the restaurant linens, tablecloths.
The restaurant linens business, that's how they infiltrate the gambling business,
yeah.
Even in places like Atlantic City. They don't own the casinos, but they own... And they control the unions, actually, that service the casino, so they can get their cut of everything. So the mob is still involved. It's the corporate mob. Big corporations are involved. And the money, again, is astounding. The stuff that Tom Keene did and Vito Marzullo did and those guys, it's penny ante stuff compared to what goes on now.
The other Quinn, Pat Quinn, governor of the state of Illinois, whom I've known for many years, from the time he was sort of a reform hustler on the streets to the present moment, told me just a little while ago that he learned the term corruption tax from me. He thinks that I coined it. I find you using the term corruption tax in your novel, The Chairman. I don't know that I can really verify or prove that I first thought of it, but I did use the term a long, long time ago on the air. I come to that basic question. We paid a high corruption tax in Chicago. That is, a lot of the money extracted from the ordinary citizen went into private pockets for non-civic purposes. To what extent do we still pay a corruption tax?
Oh, I'm sure we do. You can only talk of it in terms of percentages, but city government is much more expensive to run here than in places where it's clean. We have, for instance, we have more people. We still have three people on a garbage truck. Again, that's penny ante stuff. They have one out in the suburbs, and that's a small example. But because these contracts have to be greased, and there has to be enough for the people who grease those contracts, we pay. People try to put a percentage on it, and I've heard people on this show talk about putting a percentage on it. Is it 10%, 15%, 20%? It's quite a bit of money. And when times are going good and the city is running well and people are happy and prosperous, it doesn't make a great deal of difference. People can overlook it. But when times get hard like they are now, people get very tired of it. They're tired of paying for it. People are tired of looking at their property tax bills and saying, hey, wait, if 15% of this is going to the guys who know the guys, why am I paying this? Why do I have to pay that?
You've got a section here early in the book. It's at the beginning of Chapter 2, which really gives an excellent overview of the way Chicago works and Chicago's tolerance for gross political corruption. I've marked the extended passage. It begins on one page and runs through most of the next page. I would like to ask you now to simply read this little treatise which is contained within your novel.
Oh, certainly. Its politics remained dirty, not only because the politicians had become entrenched, with generations of the same families getting rich, or at least well off, as a result of the city's increasingly unique approach to civic governance, but also, and mostly, because its citizens had grown very comfortable with its corruption. What would have been a stench in any other city was considered an aroma in this town. Why? Because corruption worked, or at least it appeared to work. When the typical American Rust Belt city deteriorated, then collapsed in the 60s and 70s, the city had survived, indeed prospered. There were many plausible explanations for this town's being an exception to the seeming rule of urban decay, but the easiest explanation was that the political machine that ran the city had eliminated any effective opposition, so the city government could take whatever action was necessary to maintain law, order, and livability without having to deal with the niceties of constitutional law and democratic processes. At least this was the story that the most direct beneficiaries of the city's atmosphere, its politicians, peddled, and it was readily bought by a largely happy, grateful, and insular citizenry. But there is another reason that corruption and double dealing had so permeated the fabric of the city. It had become such a part of the city's self-identity that its people reveled in it. Corruption was part of the tough guy image that boys, young men, and older men who never seemed to grow up incessantly cultivated. People took pride in proclaiming that their city was run by the best politicians money can buy, and that the definition of an honest politician in their town was one that once bought, stayed bought. Even those who took no pride, indeed were ashamed of the city's corruption, had quietly resigned themselves to it. The city had always been politically dirty, and always would be so. There was nothing that could be done, some reasoned. More importantly, many secretly feared that the rarely disputed consensus was right and wondered what might happen to their admittedly well-run and great-looking, ironically one of the reasons that people accepted its political dirtiness was its physical cleanliness, city if democracy and clean government were ever made to make their debut.
As it was and shall be, now and forever. Amen.
Amen. That's exactly how it works, and people take pride in this, and you still hear people joking about it. We're not Minneapolis. Where do you think you are, Minneapolis? How many times have you heard that? People are proud of this stuff. But you know, Milt, even in the book I mentioned this, it's getting to the point where it's getting very expensive. And the entertainment is still great, but the cost-value relationship is getting skewed. And people might be getting tired of it, but maybe not. Maybe ever thus and thus shall ever be.
But I have heard that said for the last 40 years.
Right. And it never happens, does it?
No.
And maybe this recession will do it, maybe not. But people are still proud of it. People still talk about, I know the alderman. People talk about, I can do this, I can do that, because I know the alderman. I can get this done. I know somebody who knows somebody.
Well, how distinctive is Chicago in this regard? Or are other major cities capable of just as much dysfunctional corruption?
Capable, but they don't do it as well. New York.
You mean they haven't mastered the art?
They haven't mastered the art, or they lost the art a long time ago. I think New York is just too big and spread out, and I think ever since the decline of Tammany Hall and reformers such as John Vachel Lindsay, who came in and ran the city in the 60s, and they have a lot more reformers, crusading reformers in New York City, because it's the focus of the national media, right? Mm-hmm. It's harder to get away with things in New York City. The corruption is there, and you'll read stories about it, but it's not so systemic as it is here. It's not seemingly run from the center. Towns in New Jersey are notoriously corrupt. They say it ruined Newark. Newark was ruined by corruption. There are some arguments against that, but that's a plausible argument. People say Texas is as corrupt as Chicago, but there isn't one big city in Texas you can say, boy, that's corrupt. You can talk about LBJ stealing elections or whatever back in the 40s. But that's another story. We've perfected the art. We grew up in it. People grew up in the system, immersed in the system. People grew up bathed in the system. They were so immersed in the system, Milt, that they didn't realize there was anything wrong. That's just the way it is.
Have you ever wondered about the following? There are many different ethnic groups in the history of Chicago. There are newer, more newly arrived ones like the Hispanics. But classically, the Irish, the Germans, the Italians, the Jews, and the Poles and other East Europeans made up this city, did they not?
They did, historically.
And the single group that had greatest power in or did best in the political game was the Irish.
Right, correct.
Is there anything about the culture they brought from Ireland which helps to explain Chicago politics?
Well, one of the possible reasons...
And you're an Irishman.
And I'm of Irish extraction. I like to say I'm Irish-American. Let's clarify that. But anyway, one of the possible reasons I've thought about this, why are my people so good at this? Well, first, they knew the language. That's the obvious one. You get along and you can work in the halls of government more easily. But I think entrepreneurship was suppressed back in Ireland by the British. And so that avenue, which was so fruitful, you know, for the Jews, for the Poles, for the Italians... entrepreneurship is part of their culture. It never was part of the Irish culture. The Irishmen don't come over and think I'm gonna buy a push cart and push that down the street and sell things so my kid can do something else. No, they don't have that tradition. They were always on the outside. They were not allowed to get into business. Business was suppressed by the British. And so they got over here. They didn't know enough about entrepreneurship in general. Now, my father was an entrepreneur, I mean, having said this. But I don't think it's in their tradition. So they saw the way up is through government, which they saw how it worked in England, that the people who controlled the government got ahead and were able to suppress the Irish. And so maybe they come over here and take their turn at it. I think that's part of it. I also think that they managed to, back in Ireland, stick together, hold together, through the offices of the church, through neighborhood organizations, they were able to organize against the common enemy. Well, those organization skills held them well when they came over to this country and manifested themselves in the public as opposed to the private sector because of the suppression of the entrepreneurial impulse by the British. That's one theory, but I still puzzle about this. Mm-hmm. There are some great Irish entrepreneurs. I think my father was one of them. But for the most part, they saw their way up that way because they were told by the British that that just wasn't allowed. The Irish couldn't.
That's Irish a fascinating interpretation.
Well, it's an idea. Yeah. And I don't know if it's right, Milt, but I thought a lot about it. It seems to make a lot of sense.
Your central character, Eamon de Valera Collins, I know what happens to him in this novel. How much do you want to give away?
I don't want to give away too much, but he ends up having to do things he otherwise would not have done,
mm-hmm.
but which turn out to have been to his advantage. Like many times in life, we take a path that we didn't necessarily choose that turned out to be the right path for us. He was resistant to what he was effectively told to do, but he did what he had to do. He had very little choice in the matter. And made the most of it. And when my sequel comes out, we'll see he really made the most of it.
You've got a new book about to be published, are you?
It's about to be published. It should be out in late August.
The title will be?
The Chairman's Challenge, a continuing novel of big city politics.
How interesting.
And picks up exactly where this one left off.
This would make a good movie.
I think it would make a great movie, Milt.
Have they picked up on it?
No, they haven't picked up on it yet, but maybe someone's listening in Hollywood. And we'd like you to play a role in there, too, I think. You could be Leon Bernstein.
I think not.
Perhaps. And maybe not Leon Bernstein. But anyway, we'd love to have you. Or you could be Seamus McGillicuddy, the guy in the bar on the South Side.
That sounds more attractive.
Yeah. Sitting there as the Republican organizer.
But as a citizen of Chicago, I rather mourn the low state of its public life. And I would hope that in my time some true change might occur. But by now I've grown quite pessimistic.
And I'm cynical, too. And I've been around, I've been following this for almost 50 years. And I've grown I'm naturally cynical anyway, but I'm very cynical about the way things work here. Because we always hear it's going to change. And you know, Milt, the ironic thing, I guess, about this book is because people could argue that I am, in fact, celebrating the very corruption that I talk about in the book. That a book like this celebrates the corruption. I would argue with that. I mean, the characters in this book do some very despicable things. They all have, not all, but most have good sides.
But few of them are viewed by you as intrinsically evil.
Very few of them are intrinsically evil. Yeah. That's right. And so you could easily make the argument, well, you know, Quinn's glorifying these guys too. But I think if you look at the whole package, I'm not. I'm telling a story. I'm telling the story like it is.
Scoundrels are always more interesting than people of virtue, aren't they?
Sure, absolutely. You know, St. Francis of Assisi, a great, great man. They don't publish many books about St. Francis of Assisi, but Al Capone, there's a lot of books about Al Capone, and they sell.
They even put up, there was this dreadful thing they put up in downtown Chicago, sort of a tourist attraction based on the life of Capone.
It was awful. It was just west of here, actually.
Yeah, right.
And it was up for a couple of years in the very early 1990s.
It was called Capone Chicago or something like that.
It was horrible. It was tacky. It was awful. And we're trying to rid ourselves of that image. Now, should we rid ourselves entirely of that image? No, it's part of our history. But to glorify it, and people understand so little about the background of that. Al Capone becomes a cartoon character.
We should make clear to our listeners that though you've got a deep interest in this stuff and obviously tremendously detailed knowledge and comprehension of the Chicago political story, you have not been a Chicago politician.
No, I've never been involved in politics at the hands-on level. I grew up in the 19th Ward, which is a very, very political ward, probably next to the 11th, the most political ward in the city. I've had many, many friends that I grew up with and met later on who are involved in politics. But no, I never got involved in it. I actually went into the money management business as a professional money manager. I ran junk bond mutual funds in the 1980s. Talk about ending up in the right place
at
the right time. They did very well.
I'm glad to hear it.
Mine led the country in performance. Hmm. And I did very, very well. I met with the right people, did the right thing, worked hard, and that was able to afford me to pursue some of my other interests like Chicago politics, like teaching, like I do now. But my background is financial, but that has been immensely helpful in writing a book like this or in following Chicago politics, because it's following the money, Milt, and we all know that's what the people are in for. Whether you're exploring the mob or you're exploring Chicago politics or the places at which they intersect, following the money will get you to the basis of the problem or the basis of the story.
Last question, back to the present moment in Chicago politics, and the crucial question, are the feds onto any of this, and are they going to do anything about it? We've been hearing for a long time there are indictments coming, possibly even reaching the fifth floor. Is there anything to that?
I have to defer to my cynicism and say, no, we've been hearing it too long.
The fix is in.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure the fix is in. Maybe Daley has been as careful as his father, and he's kept away from it. You think if they could have gotten him, they would have gotten
him. Well, I don't mean merely Daley.
But even people at the top, some other names we can name, we probably would be more prudent not to.
I wonder about Eddie Burke, frankly.
Well, that's one name that you'd have to mention if you're mentioning these, but they've never laid a hand on him. I think he's pretty smart. But people
very
said that.
Fellow.
Very, very smart fellow, keeps ahead of things. But then we say the same thing about Ed Verdoliak.
But Verdoliak did finally get slapped. Somehow he managed not to go to prison.
Exactly my point. We said the same thing about Verdoliak. He's too smart. They'll never catch Eddie Verdoliak, and they did.
But they did convict him.
They did convict him, and he got a sentence, sentence effectively of probation.
For which the judge was criticized.
For which the judge was criticized, and is being he's being resentenced, apparently.
Uh-huh.
Or at least they're reviewing the sentencing. They're not reviewing the conviction, but apparently either an appellate-level court or somewhere higher in the district court, they're looking at the sentence.
We come to the end of the available time. Mark Quinn has been our guest. The novel we're drawing from is The Chairman, and I'm very excited to learn that the next sequel is appearing. Title again?
It's called The Chairman's Challenge, a continuing novel of Chicago politics.
And I shall look forward to it, and I'm sure I'll get as much pleasure from it as I did from The Chairman itself. Thank you, Mark, so much for joining us.
Thank you, Milt.